Okay, so here we are, Cosmos Cafe, Thursday, July 22nd, 2021. And we have a very special guest, Ben Williams, who is an assistant professor at Naropa of Hinduism and Yoga Studies. And he's here, among other things, to talk with us about a 9th, 10th, or 10th, 11th century Kashmirian philosopher, guru, poet, cultural critic, and cosmopolitan realizer, Abhivanagupta. And in addition to just learning about this very interesting figure, I thought we might make some connections with other thinkers that we've been studying and other issues that have that we've been discussing here in the cafe, and that Ben and I, in other contexts, Ben lives in the area. We're local and we're friends. Have also had many conversations about. I'm not sure how this is going to open up, but one of the beauties of the cafe format is that we all can bring our minds, our interests, our curiosities, our passions, sometimes our obsessions, to the table. And Ben, you've been very gracious not only to show up, but also to provide us with some reading material to provide, some centering and some orientation on the topic of discussion. You may also have some examples, some samples from Abhivanagupta's works, his texts, which, I know you also read in the original Sanskrit, and as well as translate. So languages and the kind of consciousness that language can hold and convey has been a topic that we've discussed, and also education has been a topic we've recently been exploring. Kind of broadly speaking, what from a philosophical level is education? We've talked about it not only in terms of the English word education, but also the rough equivalent in German Bildung. And there's a couple of cafes just previous to this one that explore that notion. A number of us are educators or former educators or perhaps future educators. So I know, Ben, that's your profession. It's something you give a lot of thought to and care to. And you also look to Abhivanagupta as a model or exemplar of what education can be or what it may entail. In the largest context. So I want to make sure we all just get to introduce ourselves quickly. We already kind of started before the recording with Andrea and Naomi, but just to let John, Michael, and Lisa, and Ed say hi. And then Ben, I would just give the floor to you for as long as you need to give your introduction, perhaps begin to approach the question, who is Abhivanagupta really? And then we'll open it up for others to give their reflections, feedback, questions, and hopefully by the end of this, we'll all have woven in, various threads of interest into a tapestry that's more resplendent than how we began. So with that said, I'll just, I don't know, let's just go around from John, just say hi. Check in.
Greetings, everybody. I'm from Manhattan. I'm an actor, writer, and also I've been a political activist. So good to see all of you. I'm really looking forward to this event. Thanks.
Just pop on in.
Hi, my name's Ed, regardless of what you might read on the screen there. I'm an expat American living in Germany. Spent 14 years in California working in Silicon Valley in engineering, and I'm now retired. So I take care of my grandson who lives in the same house and watch out for him. My interests are mostly in Western esoteric spirituality and language. I was a teacher once. I've been a lot of things, but along the way. I never had a job I was qualified for. That was that's kind of like the hallmark of my career. So But I'm interested in I've been hanging around the cafes and the Infinite Conversations platform for about 5 years now. So I'm always open to for new things. And this seemed like a really interesting topic. So that's why I'm here.
And I'll just add that, Ed, you've organized a few series as well, including the previous one on Henri Bortoft's The Wholeness of Nature, which looks at Goethe's approach to science, and also what's his name?
Bernardo Kastrup.
Kastrup, yeah, the idea of the world.
The idea of the world,
which is a philosophical defense of idealism. Philosophical idealism.
Didn't he write Kastrup just write another book that's got a really funny title? Like materialism is a bunch of baloney or something.
He did write that, but his most baloney materialism is baloney. But he also his most recent book I think is on Carl Jung.
Oh, interesting.
Just came out of last month.
Oh wow.
He's also been doing work on Schopenhauer lately. And I think he has a book on Schopenhauer, which is a thinker that we've tossed around, getting around to eventually.
Well, I'm Lisa Morosky. I'm a writer. I'm interested in language and philosophy and psychology, particularly Carl Jung. I'm working on a couple of books, and this group has been very gracious and generous in helping me chew through one of them. and I'm particularly interested in the language aspects of Sanskrit and I guess to some extent, Abhinavagupta, but I'll have a lot of questions about that later.
Great.
I guess that leaves me. I'm here in Southern California. I've lived here all my life. I've kind of immersed myself in the surfer dude flow with the flow and gone through the 60s. I'm a maintenance person with a heavy love of reading and language, mainly coming from a place that I had a speech impediment, and every time I talked, people wanted to correct my language. And so I may have a slight edginess of telling people, not you, but the way people use language to control other people that don't talk correctly or from their point of view. So I'm game for this wave that we're going to do. Whatever we're going to do, I'm riding it. Thank you very much.
And I'll just interject again to mention that Michael and John have worked on a few different talks, you know, looking at healing white body supremacy and somatic abolitionism. That's been something that they've explored in other conversations. And Lisa, she mentioned language. We have a whole series that is on a book that she's working on. We're working on too, Consciously Evolving Language. So that's also been one of our explorations. And I bring these all forth to give you a kind of richness of context, Ben, so that you know, this is not just you know talking to us or us listening passively, but really engaging with you in your passion for this topic. So I think that leaves Andrea though.
Yeah, hi there, good morning. I was just thinking, gosh, I would like to share a little more about myself too. I am originally from the Netherlands, and I lived in India in Auroville from 1971 to 1978. And so I am, one might call myself a disciple of Mother and Sri Aurobindo. So I've been reading Savitri and Sri Aurobindo since 1972. And it's never stopped nourishing and expanding my soul, my spirit. psychology. Jung, of course, is by far my favorite. So psychology and spirituality both are kind of my main interests, and personal growth, you know, is exploring, becoming aware of what drives us from below and from above, from the past and from the future. So I'm really very happy to be here with you all. Thank you. And Naomi is, okay, she has three little dogs with her, so she's a little distracted. She's going to stay out of the picture. But we are very close, and we are very in tune spiritually and mentally. So
she'll be with us.
Yeah, she's here. She's here. She's just staying out of the picture.
There. Okay. Take it away, Ben.
All right. Well, I'll just maybe say a little bit about myself by way of introduction. So I started in Naropa 4 years ago. I have a PhD in Indian religions. And upon moving here, one of my first friends was Marco. We met through a mutual friend. And it became a kind of organic, spontaneous intellectual fellowship, I would call it maybe. And I just really loved the way Marco approached imagination, his love for aesthetics and beauty, and his kind of philosophical adroitness. And we've had a lot of conversations as well about this platform and about a lot of his creative projects. And I feel aligned with you all in spirit. And even though I haven't participated, I've wanted to participate. I have read some Aurobindo, and so I wanted to participate with some of those book groups. I've also spent some time in Oroville. I actually did dissertation research in Pondicherry, and I lived in Oroville during that time. And so I feel a connection, a very deep connection to Sri Aurobindo and the mother. I would go and meditate every day in a Samadhi shrine after translating Sanskrit texts. It was a pretty ideal life for that year. And in terms of Abhinavagupta, you know, I had I grew up in a spiritual lineage that kind of tipped its hat to Kashmir Shaivism. And Kashmir Shaivism in the last century really has become, it's been like an efflorescence of this appreciation of this tradition. It's a kind of resurgence as well, in a certain sense. And a lot of it has been focused on texts some of you may have heard, like the Shiva Sutras, the Spandakarikas, the writing of Mark Dieskowski has been a very powerful bridge, and all the translations of Jaidev Singh. Jaidev Singh's an interesting figure too in the 20th century, not only a translator, but connected to the Theosophical Society. There's kind of groups of Indian pundits who kind of started to help, were instrumental in reanimating this tradition. And then there's a number of charismatic gurus that in the Indian tradition that started to transmit it. Swami Lakshmanju, a Kashmirian guru, trained many Westerners. And then Baba Muktananda kind of connected to this and became a part of his transmission. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was deeply inspired by this, the guru of the Beatles, and also the guru of people like Deepak Chopra. He went and spent time with Swami Lakshmanju in Kashmir. Amidst this kind of cloud of interest, Abhinavagupta has been kind of hidden, partly because most of his texts hadn't been translated. And although people often acknowledge him, he was more of a placeholder and less of a kind of robust presence in this 20th century reception. And so as I decided to make the decision, I'm not sure if it was the best decision to do a PhD and spend 12 years of my life doing this. It was an amazing decision, but it was definitely an austerity. I just kind of was like, well, who is this figure, you know, and I want to be able to read his writing in Sanskrit. To do that, I had to study Sanskrit intensively. And Marco mentioned that he has this polymatic kind of quality. He wrote in many different genres. So the thing about him, this is a kind of nice anecdote, and I may have shared this in the podcast, but I had an advisor, or a Sanskrit teacher, Guy Levitt, who was also working on Abhinavagupta. In his Shaiva philosophy, which is, you could say, is his religious texts, he has this expansive body of work, including philosophy of religion. And then in his writing and literary theory, which he made a huge impact in the history of Indian literary theory, he also has two very massive texts, which are kind of registering and in dialogue with incredible breadth and sophistication of the Indian aesthetics, both in terms of the written word, poetry, and plays, drama, less in terms of visual art. Now, to do justice to the relationship between these two areas in his corpus requires doing a PhD in Indian aesthetics and a PhD in Indian philosophy. because he did the equivalent of that in more in each of those. And so it's very easy, this anecdote. This is what Guy Levitt said to me, basically. He's like, you can't actually do that in one PhD. It's very easy to deal with him superficially. And that's part of why he's concealed, I would say, within a broader understanding, a generalized understanding of Kashmir Shaivism. I think a big part of my life work is to change that and to go into that and to help introduce him to the world and share him with the world. And in the process, I've gone through a process of education that is definitely inspired by him. It's an education that takes seriously a number of domains of life, a kind of cultivation of the capacity to relish beauty, a kind of philosophical chops, the ability to use a kind of, rationality in the service of deeper shared understanding and also kind of clarification and removal of confused forms of understanding, which in this tradition is foundational. In Indian philosophy broadly is foundational. It's always in service of moksha or liberation. It's never just philosophy for its own sake. A kind of immersion in different scriptural streams or revelatory knowledge, and the ability to interpret scripture, hermeneutics, exegesis, a kind of exegetical mode of thinking, which I like to relate to close reading, actually. Just the all of us are passionate readers, just the ability to actually read closer and engage the texts with more fidelity and receptivity to its power. And so he also has this capacity for synthesis, which is very distinctive. It's a signature feature of his mind, you could say. That's something that I don't quite have, but it's something I'm cultivating, I think, aspiring to in many ways. It's a kind of Aurobindian, synthesis potency that comes through his thought in his mind. So in reading in my dissertation project, I'll just say really quickly, I looked at how he represented himself as an intellectual and as a guru, as what I call a cosmopolitan siddha. The siddha traditions in tantric Shaivism and tantric Buddhism is a kind of interesting traditions of these masters, these adepts called siddhas. And he definitely represents himself as a Shaiva siddha. In these very esoteric streams, of Nandor Shaivism. But he does so, many of those esoteric streams are actually kind of anti-intellectual, interestingly. They say that intellectual learning is like a snare and you should, actually a lot of them just talk about letting go of that, you know, and the kind of futile, discursive debates that happen between traditions. And so Abhinavagupta is anything but, and he embraces the life of the mind so robustly and so intensely and with such vigor of spirit that he's not just a siddha in these traditions, he's a cosmopolitan siddha. And he's in dialogue with Kashmir. So I look at how he represents himself in these autobiographical passages. I question, why does he write so much about himself? It's a bit of an anomaly in Indian history. You don't get a lot of autobiographical writing in pre-modern India, but Abhinavagupta has over 130 verses about himself, his context, his teachers, his students. And what I argue in my dissertation is that his modality of self-representation, his kind of religious self-awareness, is modeling a deeper, it's modeling a deeper possibility for education and for the passing on of structuring tradition and how knowledge can be transmitted in living communities. And so although he recognizes there's different types of audiences with different levels of interest, I think he's really charting the course for this very powerful ideal of what education, what is an ideal curriculum for a human being at some fundamental level. That's what I argue in my dissertation. So the question of education is really important to me in terms of thinking through how can we recontextualize and bring out the power of this figure. In addition to that, I would just say that language is something that I am deeply interested in, just to mirror some of the shares. I'm actually writing a handbook entry for Oxford Handbook on cosmogenesis and phonematic emanation. So it's this idea of a continuity between language and reality and different models in the Shaiva tantric traditions, which Abhinavagupta, has a very elegant version of, which take the Sanskrit language and the syllabary and its order and see it as a map for cosmogenesis. So literally, it's like a blueprint. And then also a map for awakening at the same time. There's two directions. One is the direction of creativity, srishti krama, and one is the direction of awakening, or the kind of samhara, kind of re-enveloping into the pure plenum that is the source. So kind of like a tattva theory, if you know Sankhya or anything, like the tattvas can be seen as a map for creation and also for resorption or awakening. So
could you repeat the cosmogenesis and what was the other
syllabic thing? Phonematic emission actually is probably a better phonematic emanation or emission. A phoneme is like a letter, but in Sanskrit, the Sanskrit phonemes, like the consonants, have an inherent sound. So those are the phonemes. Yeah. So the phonemes, it's like the level of the letters, like how are they representations of like these shaktis, these powers of awareness, of universal consciousness that have this dynamism. Language is where consciousness gets its dynamism. And for them, language goes all the way up. It's not just a human construct. Anyway, we can go deeper into that, but I'll just say really quickly, like what the highest level of language is not what we use the word language as. When we say the word language, that they're not talking about that. It's like beyond that range. But it's something like this inherent dynamism or discursive potentiality within consciousness, which is why it's creative. And that's the foundation of all cognition, all, you know, all language, all communication, the, you know, yeah. It's similar to some logos kind of theories that people like Bernard Lonergan, the Catholic theologian, drew on and elaborated theologically with some important differences. Yeah. And which Derrida hated. Logocentrism. basically a big portion of my life has been studying this one figure, but to study him, I've read a lot of the texts that he had access to, and I've just been steeping myself in the tradition. And one of the things that's been a real joy, I'll end with this, is that reading with other people, I've had a lot of colleagues and friends and other scholars, and we just read texts and kind of get into a space together. It's a very powerful collective practice. And part of it's like uncracking puzzles. Part of it's seeing our shared knowledge kind of swirling around and acting in this orchestrated way. And then there's just the constant joy of like peeling back layers of what's being revealed in the texts. And I read very widely in Sanskrit. I don't stick to just a, you know, Shaivism. I read a lot of Sanskrit poetry and all kinds of stuff, a lot of Buddhist philosophy. I've studied a lot of Buddhism because Abhinavagupta debates the Buddhists. There's a lot we could go into around debate too in intellectual culture, which I'm really deeply interested in. But okay, I'm rambling now. I'll stop there. I'll pause there. Is that helpful, Marco? Is that what you're...
Yeah, that's very good. And I want to just open it up for anyone to ask questions or reflect back. But there is one story I wonder if you might reanimate for us. And that's of, you've shared it with me. And I think you may have also shared it in one of your podcasts. But it's a kind of moment when you were reading and you had this profound like connection experience in, you know, with the text. And kind of walked outside, maybe we were in Vermont, but there was something that happened or some kind of revelation that occurred to you, maybe disclosed something about the nature of language or the transmissive potential of language.
So I was, it's actually in Amsterdam, with traveling with my godfather. Yeah. And I was reading this book. And at the end of the book, the author, who's a spiritual master, shared this experience that they had. And it was a really striking experience that happened at the culmination of their sadhana. And it was, I was just, not only was I in the book and in the teachings, but this thing just, it kind of like struck my heart very deeply. And I was in a state of shock, actually, when I finished the book. It was a potent kind of conclusion to reading. And I walked outside into the city. We're staying in a hotel in the city. And all of a sudden, it was like the entire street scene was just bathed in this radiance. But it wasn't a radiance that blotted everything out. It just like seamlessly threaded through everything. And everything was unfolding in this great spontaneous choreography or dance. And I was able to just, there was no like line of separation between myself and that dance. And as it just kind of walking the street as the breeze was happening and just resting in this radiant dance. And then I had this thought, which was, how did that happen from reading a book? I didn't meet the teacher. I didn't, you know, there wasn't no touch. There was no physical, there was no like the glance, you know, I just read actually this description of the falling of, or the strike of the sidelong glance of the master or something, you know, like it was none of that. It was just from reading. And so it became an enigma for me in a certain sense. I was very young, it was before I went back to school, which was, how is the consciousness of a master encoded in a text? And how does it congeal into a text? and how is it reanimated in the reader? And this became a like deep query in a lot of my research. And in a certain sense, it kind of came back in my dissertation. It's kind of funny, the rhythm of thought over many years, you start to see these patterns and these seeds, and you see this kind of, it's almost like grace is at work in your own inquiry or something. Like there's a deeper pattern to it, even when it feels like a lot of disparate pieces. It's this question of how does transmission work in traditions? What's the life of transmission? How is knowledge transmitted? How does knowledge become deadened? How is it reanimated? What gives it its vitality? And what's the role of texts as a technology in the transmission of living knowledge? These are really at the heart of a lot of my dissertation. Yeah, a lot of my intellectual queries. And actually a verse that I might share kind of speaks to it beautifully. It's from the Krama Stotra of Abhinavagupta. So when we get a chance, I'll read this Sanskrit verse to you in the Sanskrit, and then we can talk about, it's a description of this process by Abhinavagupta. So, yeah, that's, you know, part of my love affair with reading too.
May I just jump in here for a moment? I was just so moved when you described your experience, how you can have this enlightenment experience by having read a text. And so Savitri was written by Sri Aurobindo as a transmission. He is transmitting his consciousness through the poetry in Savitri. And you can keep reading it and it keeps giving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. I obviously, Sri Aurobindo really understood a lot of these principles very deeply and worked with them. I know he constantly reworked Savitri over many, many years. Have you had similar experiences reading Savitri?
all the time. So yes, he rewrote. As his consciousness increased or heightened, however you might broadened, he would rewrite. Mm. Whenever he entered another level of consciousness, he would rewrite what he previously wrote to make sure that it was the highest possible transmission.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
And especially in reading together is that something happens, you know. Mm-hmm. I know that when I read out loud to others, it's like I feel the words because they come through my body, right? I am speaking them. They vibe. So listening, you get the vibration of the sound, but speaking it, it's even more physically tangible.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
And that, just to double click that. I was hanging out with some friends who are in the business world, and one of them did that to me. I was like, to double click that, Ben. And I was like, ooh, I like that corporate ease. I'm gonna steal that. To double click that, you know, the Indian tradition is primarily oral, even though textuality is very important. And there's a kind of process of textualization, which before the printing press, that was very important, significant. It'd be nice to do like a McLuhan analysis of these things, the different mediums of transmission of the word and speech. But the oral tradition, of course, you know, it's the vibratory sound of the words coming through the master or the teacher, the acharya. And so that context is so far removed from private reading. You know, it's a very different context or medium than private reading. And the way in which words vibrate inside of our being, they really do carry, they encode features of the awareness that's speaking them. So there's this beautiful verse in the Shiva Sutras, even the casual speech of the guru is mantra. Katha japaha. And so this is why when you're speaking to a great being and they say like, you know, like Neem Karoli Baba, like, have you had your breakfast, you know, or something. he's just saying the most casual thing. Neem Karoli Baba never gave philosophical teachings. He just said stuff like that all the time. But the power of his words were like mantra. You know, they would mean everything. They speak from beyond time and space, you know. So there's many anecdotes and experiences that I've had around this too.
So as a sacred language, let me step back a step or two. So in some Native American traditions, the shamans, the spiritual people, have sacred language, which is not shared with, you know, just the average people, mm-hmm. because it's used for sacred purposes. And because it's so powerful, in this sense of, you know, the vibratory, the ability to create through vibration, basically. And that's, you know, sort of the first thing I learned about Sanskrit many years ago was that it was a language that was used to literally create reality through its vibrational emanation. And so I'm wondering if, I mean, from what I hear you saying, there almost isn't that same kind of distinction between, well, we have our sacred language and we have our profane, that's not quite the right word. Let's just say our common language. That the gurus could essentially be mixing that, it sounds like, using just sort of common language, but with this sacred intention. So could you talk a little bit more about the use of Sanskrit as a sacred language versus a common language? And are there similar kinds of, you know, you only use this for the sacred part? Are there distinctions like that?
Yeah. Is it okay if I get a little historical in my response?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So in the earliest Vedic tradition, Sanskrit was reserved for very specific usages related to Vedic ritual. And the earliest form of Vedic ritual was not as fixed. So the layer of the Rig Veda, the rishis would have spontaneous Sanskrit hymns. And there's a notion and then it kind of became canonized and routinized in the, what's called the mantra period, and then the formation of the four Vedas. In that context, Sanskrit was not used. In the earliest, it wasn't used for bartering, for inscription. Ashokan inscriptions were not in Sanskrit. They were in this old Prakrit language. It was not used for finance. It was really reserved for this sacred, deep context. And a lot of the kind of foundational ideas around the power of Sanskrit emerged within the early Vedas. One of the ideas is that the poets, they're sages, they're seers, and they're poets. They're called rishis, right, in Sanskrit. But they're also called kavi, which means poet. When they would intone these mantras, basically all of the Veda came to be known as mantra. The power of a mantra is it's a speech act that changes reality. It's a speech act that somehow shifts reality. even when you get, you know, the later texts like the great epic, the Mahabharata, when they shoot weapons, sometimes they'll use a mantra with a weapon and it like supercharges the weapon, right? So mantras can be seen as weapons and as well, you know? In the Vedic context, a lot of it is setting up these lines of communications with the Vedic pantheon of gods and establishing this thing called Ritta, which is something like a harmonious order of the worlds that allows everything, like the rains to rain at the right time, et cetera. And kind of warding off the powers of chaos. So, and then there's other things like suns and cows, and, you know. So what happened, there's a book, it's called Language of the Gods in the World of Men by Sheldon Pollack. And it's a historical account of how this restricted domain of the sacred language, it burst its bounds. And suddenly you have Sanskrit inscriptions written by kings. That's really pretty early. You have the birth of Sanskrit literature. You have the great epics. You have early poems. You have Sanskrit, the birth of Sanskrit knowledge systems as well. You have these philosophical streams that emerge in Sanskrit. And it's kind of a layering process. It starts with like, how do we interpret the Vedas? But then suddenly you have texts written outside of the Vedic domain completely. Then you have the adoption of Sanskrit by Buddhist authors. And you get this Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. Much of the history of Buddhist philosophy is in the Sanskrit language. You get the birth of new texts, new revelatory traditions, which are seen to supersede the Vedas. These are called the Tantras or the Agamas, a kind of new scriptural a new horizon of scriptural identity. So then you get Sanskrit texts on how to grow trees, how to take care of horses, like how to maintain cities, parks. It's at the how to make perfumes, perfume recipes, right? I know someone who wrote a dissertation on perfumes in pre-modern India, and he had a French perfume maker make them for his dissertation defense, and they like actually sampled them.
Oh, cool.
In my department. So at that point, you're like, okay, this notion that it's some kind of exclusive language that has this very restricted power is now kind of broken open, right? Nonetheless, it comes to have a new sense of value as a cosmopolitan language, much like Latin. And even in Sanskrit literature, when people not from certain class or women speak in the play, they speak in Prakrit, right? So you have certain notions of this Sanskrit being used still as having a certain kind of prestige, right? To write a text in Sanskrit is a very conscious decision. Another interesting thing I'll just say, there's a historical bit, but it's really fascinating in terms of a comparative lens, is in terms of the Latinate order, you have a certain moment where you have the birth of vernacular languages into writing. They were spoken for centuries, but like with Dante in the birth of Italian literature, right? Or suddenly the birth of French literature, the same thing happened in India. It's amazing. All of a sudden you have texts in Marathi, in Kannada, in Gujarati, in Bengali, in Malayalam, in Telugu, right? It's like literally there's a birth and it's like vernacularization is what it's called as a process. Okay, that's a big picture thing. Nonetheless, there's this trope that there's something unique about Sanskrit. you hear it in a lot of yoga studios, you know, like just the very sound of it. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, he said he didn't even teach Sanskrit grammar to his students. He said, all you have to do is recite the text. You'll get the meaning from the sound, right? all you need to hear is the sound vibration of Sanskrit. And the meaning, there's like some kind of fundamental trust. You'll get the meaning, right? That is bullshit. That is utter bullshit. I've met these devotees. They don't know the meaning of these texts. The tradition itself always emphasized meaning, right? Like their whole world, their whole linguistic world is full of like semantic, you know, engagement. That's what it is, you know, that's what it's animated by. And there's a kernel of truth to it. And especially in Vedic recitation, a lot of the tradition, they actually, the Brahmins stop learning the meaning and they just learn the sound and they master the sound. And there is a way in which that sound of Vedic recitation and other forms of recitation is just like a river that washes over you. And so although you won't necessarily be able to produce the meaning, there is this transformative power to the vibratory, you know, frequencies of this language. There's no doubt in my mind. I've also heard, you know, the Quran chanted in Arabic and felt that wash over me and felt a similar kind of fundamental potency, you know, just indescribable, like information communicated through the sound alone.
Have you or anybody else on this call, I know some of you are familiar with, you know, Rudolf Steiner's work and what's the name of his educational system?
Anthroposophy?
Waldorf. Yeah. So one of the things that they do in Waldorf school is they have a Kladni plate, which, you know, it's a metal plate and you put some fine powder or sand on it and you run a sound through it, you know, like a violin bow, or you could chant, you know, om or hum or, you know, any of those. And the sand bounces around until it forms a pattern. I mean, it really manifests a pattern, and each vowel manifests a different pattern. Did you ever try that?
I haven't myself.
That's Hans Jenny, isn't it? Cymatics, is that what you're describing?
Yeah.
Cymatics is at the level of water. It's looking at, you know, water molecules or how they self-arrange.
Yeah, it started with sand. The water is a really modern invention.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Just have a question.
Sort of open it up to everybody. I think our bodies are vibratory. We're much more like a drum. Pounding, but we also can create different kinds of rhythms. I so many different ways of going about this discussion, and thank you very much, Ben, for your sharing, because I'm really vibrating with a lot of what you're describing. I live in Manhattan. Hart Crane, Allen Ginsberg, Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, James Merrill, all of whom identified as gay men, operated about 2 minutes from where I live. Okay, so I felt, and some wise person, I don't know who the critic was, said that New York is actually it's Black, gay, and Jewish voices overlapping that create the New York vibe. I think there's a lot of truth to this, but I can walk out on the street. I mean, Ginsberg used to sit at the bus stop right at the corner here, and I feel this, and it had a vibe, a very queer vibe too. And of course, as I'm a gay man, that's why I came to New York, as sort of a refugee escaping from the middle-class suburbs. But I think this, what I found so weird about the internet age, which we're all beneficiaries and victims of, we are being brought into close proximity in some ways, and yet there's an enormous distancing that's happening. Because for me, as I go out into the street, that vibe, that New York vibe produced by all those different kinds of rhythms that were being caught, given and received, it's virtually gone. Because the flat screens have so distorted, I think, the collective somatic intelligence that it's virtually gone, except for last summer when Black Lives Matter ripped apart the city. Mm-hmm. And I marched with them. And I could feel, oh, it's still alive. So these young people, they're doing more than just looking at their flat screens. Obviously, they can still catch a vibe and share it. And even older persons like myself can be swept up in that dynamic. And I'm trying to figure out here in this discourse event we're all laying out and vibing with each other and talking about performance. There is, I think you mentioned, that the audience member shares the heart.
Yeah.
And there is the sensitive performer who's sharing the heart. So it's the text embodies and it also awakens and it can be vocalized exterior fashion in a group dynamic. So I'm very fascinated about those different levels of the pre-verbal and then the verbal and then the spoken. And I think as you studied so much about the old traditions, I think this is fascinating. And just one question about what were the popular, was there a popular theater vernacular in his time and place? I mean, I know there was court theater. I'm just curious, and I'm very ignorant about theater in Sanskrit. But were there any popular forms of theater that he was familiar with? I know you said he was a great critic, and he probably went to see a lot of different shows and different performances.
Yeah.
Was there something?
I'd be happy to share that. Yeah, yeah, I know a little bit about that. I've been reading with an Indian woman who's a classical dancer and a Sanskritist. We've been reading the Abhinava Bharati. This is his dramaturgical treatise on the tradition of theater. It's a really massive text, untranslated, his commentary. So it's been really fun to read. There's been some good work on the theory of rasa within the theater and how that works. But there's all these other elements to classical Indian theater. It's like a very robust tradition. In the beginning of that text, Bharata, this kind of mythic sage who's the human author of this system, you can tell he has some anxiety in his project because theater in his time is something that's not necessarily like an elite activity. He's trying to encompass it into the Sanskrit tradition, but there's awareness that there's modes of theater that are very folk oriented and that for certain kind of people would not want to be seen dead in that context, actually. And so in the most orthodox Dharma system teacher is Manu, like the laws of Manu, right? So it's called the Manava Dharma Shastra, this text. It's famous, everyone always quotes it because it's like the most patriarchal, it's the most, you know, tight ass, it's the most all this stuff. And actually the British really glommed onto it. And they said, oh, this is India's system of law. And then they just read Indian history through the spectrum of what one uptight Brahmin thought in the 5th century CE, which has created huge trauma. So Manu says, don't go to the theater. It's interesting. And Abhinava Gupta says, you know, that's bullshit, first of all. And then he says, and the Yajnavalkya, this other author who's also tied to the Upanishads, there's this Yajnavalkya Smriti. And that's another text. It's a part of a broader tradition of legal reasoning and law and social philosophy, you could say, Dharma Shastra. And he says, yeah, the theater is not a problem. But what's interesting is there's an anxiety around it, or in terms of orthodox circles and non-orthodox circles. You have kings writing plays and some really good ones. You have many different genres. You have farces, right? You do have certain social codes encoded into plays. It's interestingly like Harold and Maude could never be written in Sanskrit. Or if it was, it wouldn't invoke the romantic rasa of love, because there's no way an old woman and a young man, right, that could evoke it. You need two people, the prime of their lives, right? Like there's certain kind of orthodox social assumptions that inform the aesthetic. But that said, there's within the practice of theater in plays and in writing, the playwrights, right? They're constantly breaking all of the theoretical conventions that the theorists are trying to impose upon them. And they're playing with them in really creative ways and opposing them. So you have a kind of dynamism of a tradition of playwrights, and then you have the theorists who are trying to, and the critics. A similar kind of dynamic, I imagine, exists in every, in every art circle from ever since, right, or and before, right, where the critics are saying one thing, like jazz critics, right, and then the jazz musicians are like, oh my God, these, who are these people? You know, what is wrong with them? So Abhinavagupta is kind of dancing around that. Of course, he's not interested in that orthodox world at all. He's a part of communities that embrace some of the most transgressive modes of being and rituals and, you know, lineages. But he is, he's got this incredible public intelligence, and he's trying to, you know, he's trying to transform the world, you know, at broader and broader levels. And so he can speak at the public level and at the private level. That's a little bit around that. In terms of the experience of the poet and the actor and the audience, Abhinavagupta has an Anandavardhana, they speak to this a little. There's a way in which there's a thread of awareness between all three of those, that the poet enters into a state of inspiration. It's called pratibha. It's an amazing Sanskrit word. Pratibha is the something like intuitive imagination. And when pratibha is active in a poet, they come up with something that you're like, when you read it, you're like, how could anyone have thought of that? You know? Now, I'll give you an example that is given sometimes in the literary tradition. There's this this example in this poem. It's like there's this woman whose lover died. He was like a prince and she was a nymph. And when she found out the news, she screamed so powerfully. And when the deer in that forest remember the scream, when the deer in the forest remember that scream, the grass falls out of their mouth because they're just in wonder. So it's commenting on the character of the scream through the subjectivity of a deer. And then this image of like grass falling out, it's like, how could you think of that? Like, that's just so beautiful and exquisite. That's pratibha. It's something that literally, it's like comes ex nihilo, right? And so they compare it to how Prajapati, the creator of worlds, creates the worlds, right, out of his imagination. So poets have this capacity of just raw, creative, you know, light that can shine through them. And when they're writing, they're actually resting in that. And that is because they're communing with the kind of the deep tributary of emotion that's at the heart of that imagination. That's called rasa. It's the essence. And when an actor, there's a lot of debates about this, but when an actor performs it, there's a part of them that starts communing with that as well. And they become a vehicle for then the audience of sahradayas, of the sensitive audience, to share their heart with that, which is the meaning of sahradaya or connoisseur. That's what it means to be sensitive. It means to share, the ability to share your consciousness with that. And so that requires the removal of a lot of obstacles in the audience. And Abhinavagupta lists the obstacles. And it's one of the most trenchant psychological analyses of aesthetic experience ever. One of the obstacles is you can't have any pragmatic goals. You have to just be there to be kind of swimming in the art. Whatever you're seeing, you're not meant to relate it to your own life or your own experience, right? Oh, that reminds me of Jerry, that asshole, or whatever. You know, like that should not be a part of it. There's this thing happens where the experience of time and space falls away. Not only of yourself, but even of the time and space of the story, right? Like in these moments of kind of rustic relishing, because if it's grief, it's not just delimited by the details and content of that story. There's certain moments where it opens up into a much deeper grief. And when that grief is relished, that's something like pathos or the rasa of compassion, right? because it's capital G grief. It's a grief that is, it reverberates through every aspect of life. And so, you know, or that is a much deeper structure of being human. And so, and yet it's in dialogue with the particularity of the story and the actors and the performance. And so all of that's just adorning it and giving it more and more beauty, but it's not limited to it. So Abhinavagupta describes this process very powerfully. And there seems to be a thread between the poet and the actors and the audience. And what a lot of art is for him is just simply finding ways to participate in that thread. And from any of those perspectives, as the author, as the actor, or as the listener or the audience. And then he pulls his final move in some of his stuff. He says, well, all of those are Shiva. This is the Triloka Nataka. This is the play of the three worlds, my friends. This is the theater of the three worlds, right? This is the theater, this is the universal theater, right? Who's the director? Who's the playwright? Who's the actors, right? He's got a non-dual framework, right? It's this great cosmic production, right? It's a metaphor, it's a deep metaphor that he uses. And that gives a clue for how do you go from experiencing these types of transcendence within beauty in the play or when you're reading to when you're walking down the street, you know, in your pedestrian kind of life, you know? Yeah. So I think that's a subtle bridge to a kind of what we could call a dramaturgical perspective on reality, on life.
Thank you so much.
So
it really reminds me of Indian music, what happens. Like the more ecstatic the performer becomes, the more you can feel and see and hear the audience resonating and being uplifted until the whole thing is just like, woo!
I can tell you've experienced it powerfully. My advisor, one of my advisors, another name for a connoisseur is a rasika. And she says, if you ever want to see a rasika in India today, go to a classical Indian performance and look at the people who are sitting on stage not playing. Sometimes they just have people sitting up there, you know, and you can just, they're almost modeling this. How do you become completely absorbed in the sound and in the music and in the raga, in the shape of the raga and in the rasa? And then that's partly, I think, why they're there, because then the audience is not only seeing the performance, they're seeing the reaction to the performance, right? Like when they just go, you know, or like it's like when you're at a show and you hear someone like whistle at the right moment, it's like, you know, like, or like, woo, like, you know, oh my God, it's, yeah, this is a kind of collective effervescence. I'm really interested in this, actually. Randomly, in relationship to Grateful Dead concerts, that's like a side passion for me. But Abhinavagupta has this passage where he describes collective effervescence, the way in which the light of everyone's consciousness starts reflecting off the mirror of each other's hearts. And it becomes this like lattice of radiance. And it's one of the most, it's for people who the hardness of their sense of individuality has melted. They've learned how to allow it to melt. And so there's this way in which consciousness starts to communicate with itself in those gatherings. And it has incredible potency, you know? So this kind of intersubjective dimension is something that he was aware of. And they, in terms of going all the way back full circle to the sand and also to our bodies, they've done studies of people in plays, and they've shown that, like, or in musical performance, they show that the heartbeat actually synchronizes in people when they're hearing music, right? So that kind of synchronization of the body, of the vibrations of the bodies in that space is definitely happening. I mean, Abhinavagupta's speaking to that in the 10th century.
I'm being triggered right now by a memory of Joseph Chilton Pierce, who was a student of Muktananda, and he wrote several books on, you know, esoteric Western and Eastern traditions. But he tells a story, which I think fits in our conversation, of a man, a Western man in India, who was really interested in, who heard about a rare performance that was being conducted in a village somewhere. So he went and he saw, along with a partner of his who had a camera who was filming it. There was a little boy and a man on stage or on a platform of some kind in front of this basically peasant audience. And there was a basket. The basket was opened and a rope. And I think the man was blowing, had a flute or something, and a rope went up out of the basket. The little boy climbed the rope, and then arms, legs, hands severed, fell down and into the basket. And the old guy stopped playing his flute. He pulled the rope into the basket, put a lid on it, and walked off stage to incredible applause. And then they were really excited that they got this rare thing on film. And when they saw the film, all it was it was the man, the little boy, and the basket, and the man was playing a flute. That's all that the camera captured. But I find that extremely compelling evidence that the pre-modern imagination, or what we would call in Gebserian language, pre-modern imagination, in its healthy forms, was so much more intense than what we've got. I think our modern minds are quite incapacitated by the pseudo logic that we're enforced in our educational systems to conform by. So I'm just hoping that in this new age that's happening, can we contact those healthy forms of the mythic and the magical as we move towards a trans-rationality rather than a pseudo-rationality, which I think is dominating certainly our scientific discourse and most of our religious thinking as well. So I'm just sharing that because I think some of that impulse is happening here. I mean, we share readings together, we recite poetry together, we do our best with these limited flat screens, which, you know, basically just cuts us off from the neck up, it's all. But we can still hear our voice. We can still hear there's a voice, and we can make gestures if we pay attention to that and do it deliberately. I think these are ways of overriding the commercialization or commodification of our imaginations in this internet age, which has only gotten amplified by the pandemic. Anyway, any thoughts or feelings about that? I'd love to hear. Thank you.
Thanks for jumping in. Yeah, you know, it reminds me of, what's his name? The comparative mythologist who was like very popular in all these like programs.
Joseph Campbell?
Joseph Campbell, yeah. Well, you know, Joseph Campbell went to a Grateful Dead show and he was like, the kind of levels of archetypes and the kind of the powerful magic of the symbology that was moving through the psychic space. He was just like, he was in, like in kind of ethnographic heaven. He was like, this is, you know, I mean, so there's these like portals, I think, within a lot of our world that is flattening, that is deadening the power of imagination and the ability to commune with it collectively. And I think, I just want to agree that I think that that is so vital, and it's such a vital part of what it means to be a human being, you know, what it means to be, to have all of these faculties and these capacities in our being. And the collective dimension of that as well is something I'm really curious about, because I think you mentioned like certain streams of logic and how they inform education. Zach Stein, if you're familiar with his work, has really shown the kind of dark genealogy of testing, for example, you know, and how narrow of a focus it is on education and human cultivation. And yeah, I think this kind of hyper-individual self-sense as the foundation of who we are, like that wasn't the foundation of who we are for Abhinavagupta. That was a freely adopted, you know, locus of identity as a part of a much deeper cosmic play. It wasn't the ground of who we are, right? And so, yeah, I've been having interesting conversations recently about how there's certain traumas in the Western tradition that even maybe disconnect us from more indigenous Western Dionysian ecstatic, you know, ways of being, right? And so there has been, you know, with modernity and all of these things, there has been a severing, and there does need to be a reintegration and a healing, and also the beauties of modernity as well. I think what you're hinting at with transrational, I think part of that is with my work with Abhinavagupta is like saying, well, what does it mean to encounter and be in dialogue with non-Western paradigms in their fulsome nature? And what kind of embrace is that? Where like the wisdom and knowledge and ways of seeing and ways of being can actually inform in a dialogical process. And it could be from Chinese tradition, it could be from Brazilian or, you know, other indigenous traditions, whatever. So not so much a romanticism of going back, or there's no rewinding modernity, right? But in embracing all of this, but actually starting to imagine, you know, I know this is all within the realm of your conversations, like the context of planetization and William Irwin Smith versus globalization, you know, what's a planetary cosmopolitanism? I do see my work as if I want to kind of zoom out to that level, I do see my work. I am thinking along those lines, actually, and with the deep conviction that there is a lot to learn beyond the kind of caricature of Indian spirituality that's received, you know.
I like to, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but a big point throughout listening to this has been what's been coming up for me, you know, the oral tradition, this is what I have picked up. So it's hit and miss too. You know, the oral tradition, sound, the whole gamut performance and stuff. And a lot of people know that I was traumatized in 2000 and I've been recovering. And the biggest work for me has been more of working with my ability to receive, to open. And what I hear a lot of spiritual teachers that I think I'm saying from my, I'll put it from my, it is sometimes I'm wondering how much are they really promoting the listening, the receiving in, not just the transmitting. I get that. But a lot of the reason that there's no growth is a lot of people don't know how to receive.
Yeah.
You know, they're stuck at trauma, different levels. We're all stuck at different levels, and maybe not even trauma, just stupid bullshit that we grew up with, you know? And so Ben, I'm interested because I sense you have something to say about this receiving in, this ability to receive.
Yeah, I do. Thanks for that. I've been actually having dialogues with an art therapist at Naropa, Michael Franklin, and how can we think of some of Abhinavagupta's understandings of the experiences of beauty in terms of healing trauma and in its relationship to trauma. And one of the things that in art therapy, you're creating space for people to create art is one thing, like that's very therapeutic, but also to appreciate art and to experience art, like artistic cognition at some fundamental level, right? And what's our relationship to our emotions? Like a kind of emotional intelligence. I feel like rasa theory is a very refined emotional intelligence, because what, instead of being scared of emotion or trying to have certain emotions and not others. The idea is that you have this full spectrum of emotion and you want to penetrate into the heart of it.
Yes.
Right. And at the heart of it, it's like you have to go through it. And at the heart of it is actually, this might not be easy, but it's more beautiful, you know, is the idea, right? No matter what it is, if it's fear, right? All of these things. And so the key to that for Abhinavagupta is sahradayatva, like this capacity to share your heart with something. And that he also uses a term for receptivity. This is it's a form of receptivity is what it is. And so in my dialogues with Michael Franklin, we were like, what is the principle of receptivity in this experience, in this experience of having a relationship to one's own emotions that is able to be in dialogue with like the gifts of those emotions and the beauty in at the heart of them.
Yeah. And I just want to add, because you're going, one of the things that I had to learn is challenge the way I even talk about my emotions, because society has told us anger is bad. Sadness is bad for boys. Right. Anger is bad for girls. You know, we have this linguistic overlay, I think, that we need to question is, am I on track with what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think this is a big part of our relationship to emotions that doesn't allow us to enter them, you know, fully. And there's a lot one could say about, okay, well, what are the conditions for doing that? And I do feel like, in a certain sense, it's like, well, what do the emotions have to say?
Mm-hmm. They're messages. They're exactly. Kind of messages.
You know, like, can I actually listen to what the message that they're trying to communicate to me? Or do I just want to turn off the signal, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of what got me on this thread a little. And I really feel it's one of the most rarest and most beautiful things to cultivate is this capacity, you know, especially for people who have a lot of ideas and want to transmit them and are really inspired. And, you know, and it's like, and then they just start like absorbing everyone else's ideas into that, you know, that whole thing, you know, it's like,
well, that's an interesting thing. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ben, but this pandemic really challenged and upped my game of how to be receptive, because the pandemic sent a signal that was coming from around the world, not just my little corner. And so the intensity wasn't just of my own concern, but layered with the concern of all of humanity. What do we do? You know, it's freak out time. You know. And so one of the things I had to work on is that receptivity of kind of slowing down, of picking up so much collective signal and working with my own in a grounded way, so that, okay, now I can open up just in a regulated way to the collective. I don't want to shut off the collective, but man, during the pandemic, some of that signal from the collective, I was eating bad. I was sleeping too much. You know, I was grumpy. So all that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of thresholds to this, and it's not just about dissolving the barriers, you know, like the boundaries are really important, you know, and the filters are important. And that's how I understand this cultivation. It's like having the strength of self-sense to open up to broader and broader bandwidths, you know, and Abhinavagupta embodies that so powerfully, I think. I get lost in the maelstrom myself during this pandemic, you know. Having students going through it and being a professor and feeling responsible and connected to them, it's a lot. I've been feeling it through that as well. And yet there's been some moments where we've just been like, it's okay to feel this way, you know, like let's share, let's get into what's really arising here. Where are we at? And then it's like, then the kind of depth and heart comes in sometimes to the space. And
yeah, and that's where I think the art of theater works that way. I was in community theater, and what you just described, when any play I did, there was a sense of community. I mean, we were dealing with roles and, you know, different scripts, but I think theater is a good way to cultivate this. I also happen to think that martial arts is too, because both of them share about working with this tension. There's this bodily tension that a lot of us have to learn to relate and cultivate.
Yeah.
And I do think a lot of the spiritual works I've read, you know, help me intellectually take on the idea, but then, you know, you have to take the idea and then cultivate it and enact it. And that's a different level of experience, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I think in art therapy too, there's a lot of work within theater, like psychodramas and that kind of thing too, right? Where a lot of this can be a really powerful medium for that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's
thank you, Ben.
Yeah, thanks.
There's a German, I'm sorry, I'm forgotten his name, but a German psychologist, I guess, who use this way of helping people work through traumas by having them, you know, put the people in their lives into a certain configuration. Are you familiar with this, Michael?
Is this Gestalt therapy? Is this Fritz
Lang?
No,
it's not.
Gessmann, Hans Werner Gessmann.
You're talking about Gestalt, right? Aren't you, Lisa?
No. I think his name starts with an H.
Oh.
Anyhow, I did this one time, and I was just, you know.
Is it Hellinger? Is it
Hellinger? Family? Yes. Yeah. Thank
family,
you.
Family yeah. therapy. Family mind. Yeah. Great stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Family constellations too.
Right. Yeah. Right, family constellation work.
Yeah.
And it was such a profound experience because I was cast in this role, you know, in this person's family. And, you know, I had never met this person before in my life. And like spirit worked through me. Like stuff happened, I did things, and spirit just came through in that kind of, what was the word you used? Pratipa? Pratipa?
Pratipa, yeah.
Pratipa,
yeah.
And anyhow, it's just, it was so healing for her. It was amazing for me to have this kind of moment of like being an instrument for something greater than myself. You know, I had never experienced that before, and it was just healing on so many levels.
I just spent some time with a group of men who are a friend group in Boston, and one of my friends shared their experience of family constellation like 3 days ago. And he had to play a bunch of roles, and there are also things that were enacted related to his father, his grandfather, his great grandfather. And oh my God, my hairs were standing on end as he was describing these experiences. If you have a really powerful facilitator, it's like you can reenact these deep karmic dynamics in a family line and release them, you know?
You sure can. I mean, I was a practitioner and a student of hypnotherapy for many years, and people can have intractable problems and their conscious mind just gets so much in their way. You could just go into a pleasant trance state. And what does your unconscious know about this? And let the unconscious unload in the language of the unconscious, which is usually a combination of different senses and different modalities and different dimensions.
And then, but we, and these are happening all the time in our reveries and our dreams and our and everyday trance states, but we've been taught and trained not to pay any attention to them because we have a very profound monophasic culture. The only phase of consciousness that matters at all is the waking state. And I think we're in this deep, that's very traumatizing because I feel like some of our insights and our ability to awaken to our this somatic intelligence, and as you were describing, the different how it goes back in the family line and into the underbelly of the culture that you are a member of, and it's very vibratory and accessible, but it does generate a lot of fear because we think, oh, I'm having a paranormal experience. I don't know. I don't have a manual for this. And this is really scary. I better pretend like it's not happening and I'll never tell anybody it did. You know? and I think it, but it doesn't go away. I think it ends up turning into something very morbid. If you don't have an art form in which you can join others and release yourself from personalizing it into putting it into a, that family constellation or that cultural constellation. And the right now, I think we're in a huge shift where there's deep, deep, unaddressed, unheard, underfelt traumas. And I think this white body supremacy theme we were working with last summer, we use something called clean space, which comes out of Hellinger's work. Where you find a space that knows about this. Go to that space. What do you know from here? And the person knows a hell of a lot. Then find another space that knows about this. And so space becomes a partnership. There's a partner, a therapeutic partnership can happen with space when it becomes psychoactive that way. It can be coordinated rather than people just go into a psychoactive space and go crazy. You know, they're knocking, grabbing, acting, chop everybody up. Just sharing that with you guys. I think we have worked on this theme quite a bit, I think.
We have, John. And I think one thing I've learned is when you can take an obstacle, and I mean a concrete obstacle, and turn it into an object of inquiry, you've changed the way you relate to it. And you've gotten out of objectifying, it's just an object. That shift, that training, which I think what I'm hearing is part of the spiritual masters try to teach you is how to relate to obstacles in the mind, in the mind body. And you can, and the only, the funny thing to me, the only way I can relate to those is through a felt aesthetic sense in the sense, fuck, this hurts. I don't want this. And if Freud did anything for us, the denial of that hurt is our problem. Freud challenged the notion of how we deny. Does that make sense?
A lot of sense, a lot of sense. And one of the obstacles that Abhinavagupta describes to this kind of experience is an exclusive identification with an individual person. That's actually an obstacle. It's like an opacity that doesn't allow the beauty to stream in.
and it's the over-identification, not that we can't walk with it. It's that over-identification.
That's
maturity, the maturity that can come with it, if that's the right word.
Exactly, because he doesn't, unlike Vedanta, he doesn't want you to disidentify. He's just concerned about making that the ceiling of your identity. You know, that's why it's the exclusive identification or the over-identification. Yeah, like as you said it. But there's a way in which his non-dual tantric philosophy deeply affirms every crystallization at every level, you know, of consciousness, and sees it as an adornment. In the whole manifest world as an adornment
if you don't mind, I want to share an experience I had many years ago, and this is about 15 years ago, shortly after my trauma. I think it was about in 2001. I worked for the state of California Parks and Rec, and I worked at Chino Hills State Park, and one day part of my job was to go out and drive the trails and check the trails and what works they need. And one day I I did that, and then I pulled over and I had lunch and I laid on the earth, and it probably was, I entered what John would say maybe a altered state or a trance state, but it wasn't completely, my identity wasn't lost. It's like I could still feel my body on the earth because I was laying on the earth. But the experience was my experience expanded so far or transcended just the body that it was like I was an astronaut seeing the earth just floating in emptiness or what appeared to be emptiness, you know? And I didn't notice the sun, thank God, because it probably was too fucking bright, but I did, I felt the earth allegorically like a ball in an ocean, but in empty space. And the juxtaposition of that experience was a peace and a lack of, I still had my identity, but I wasn't attached to my identity. And that experience has informed me a lot ever since in different ways.
Let me just pick up, come in here, because we have, typically we go between 90 minutes and 2 hours. We're about an hour and 40 minutes. So we have maybe, if you have the time, Ben.
I should probably leave with a little window before the 2 hour mark, because I have a Sanskrit reading session actually with a colleague from UVA, and I wouldn't mind making a salad or something before that. But I'd say like 11 more minutes, you know.
Okay, so
sense, yeah.
Let's you know, bring this to a closing point. Is there time for you to read that text that you had?
I think so. Yeah, I could share a verse. I could do that. Yeah.
I think it'd be nice to hear some Sanskrit and some direct transmission of Abhivanagupta, as it were. And if there's more time beyond that, maybe this is just a placeholder for a future discussion. But I think it would be interesting to discuss or address what we could call the integrality of Abhivanagupta, and particularly, I don't know whether that anything like that word was available to him, but at least everyone on this call and, you know, others in our networks would be familiar with that term and would associate it with certain thinkers who might share some of the general patterns of Abhivanagupta's ontology. And so I think it'd be interesting just at least to comment on that, and although it's also a much larger topic.
Sure. I could do my best on that. Yeah. So I was, in terms of a verse, I was looking at a few different options. This is from a text called the Krama Stotra. I wonder, can I share my screen?
You should be able to. Give it a try.
I can. I think I can. All right, let me minimize this one. Go through a couple of the, let's see. Can you all see this?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll read the Sanskrit first. This is this text called the Krama Stotra. A stotra is a praise of him. And it's a praise of him in a tradition, a Shakta tradition, a goddess tradition, which is called the Krama. That Abhinavagupta really saw as the most esoteric of all the goddess traditions that he was in reception of. And it's a beautiful hymn. And it starts off like this. This is like the very first sound. Ayam dukkha vrata vrata parigame parana vidya mahasaukhya sara prasarana rase durdinamidam yadanya nyakritya vishama vishiko vishika ploshana guru viposto treshashvat pratipalati cheto gatabayam. So that's the sound of the Sanskrit. This, I'll read in English, this is the ceremony that ends the fast of long and arduous ascetic observances, full of suffering. This is the dark cloudburst when nectar flows in torrential downpours of intense bliss. By letting go of everything else, the mind, now free of fear, is perpetually reflected in the praise of the all-pervasive Lord, the guru who burns up Kamadeva. Okay, so he starts this hymn praising Shiva. It's a hymn of praise. What he does in this hymn is he talks about the act of praise itself in a very non-dual way. The one who's praising, the object of praise, are not fundamentally different realities. And so therefore, the act of praise itself is the way in which this non-dual consciousness enacts itself. And he's participating in the stream. This is a stream, in a revelatory stream, where a lot of the, here we have, it's described as this ceremony, aparana vidhi. It's a technical term for after you do a long fast, you break it with a feast, right? And fasting is a big part of ritual culture in India. And so the fast represents like all of these, effort-based, arduous austerities that you would practice in all these other traditions. This tradition now is, and the foundation of that is like breaking that fast. So it's an effortless path. It's a path in which all of that kind of efforting completely dissolves. And it's like a dark cloud burst, right? It's okay, imagine during the monsoon season in India, right? You get these like really potent clouds that suddenly release nectar, rasa. Here the term rasa is also what we're talking about as well, this like this aestheticized emotion, but also a deeper meaning of this kind of nectarian essence that is like ambrosia, a synonym of amrita, which is just flowing in these asaras, these downpours of mahasaukya, of like intense delight. So it's this is how he starts the text. This is the parana vidhi. What is this? It's like this, he's like, and in this text he goes in to elaborate this very personally. He uses a lot of first person pronouns to describe his experience, and really quickly he describes how that transmits to others. This is the piece. Vichitra jatyadi brahmana paripati parikarai avaptam sarvagnam radaya yadana ayatmina bhavata tadantas twadbodha prasarasarani bhuta mahasi sputam vachi prapya prakataya vipostotra maduna. Okay, in this verse, Abhinavagupta addresses his own heart. Oh, heart. Right, that's the object of the address. In virtue of endlessly roaming through myriad sequences of birth and death, O heart, you have now effortlessly realized this sarvajna, this all-knowing state. Transfer that clearly into speech, whose radiant power forms a pathway for the outward flow of your inner awakened awareness, and make manifest a praise poem to Shiva now. So he's addressing his heart. His heart is what is encoded in here is a very bold statement about the cosmic address of Abhinavagupta's consciousness to a certain extent, right? He's saying, look, my heart has been through all of these travails over lifetime, but now, right, there's been this cloudburst, right? There's been this, I've broken my fast of endless suffering, and I'm going to use my speech as this unique vehicle, a luminous pathway for this awareness, this inner awakened awareness, bodha, right? From the root bud, which is the same root for the word buddha, right? The awakened one. This awakened awareness, I want to transmit it sputum, like clearly, like vividly, vachi, into speech. And so this is what I'm doing with this stotra, with his praise poem. That's exactly what I'm up to right now in this moment. And even when he says now, it almost invokes this immediacy, right? Like, it's like, oh yeah, we're reenacting the text right now. We're participating this right now, right? We're hearing the very voice of the master right now. This is an amazing text that I've been translating recently. I could have shared a billion and one things, but because I've read a lot of his writing in Sanskrit.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Apropos, yeah.
You kind of sang it. Is that paralinguistic quality somehow in the words themselves? How did you know, like, what tones?
What melody?
Yeah.
It's one of many options, basically. There's many ways to sing a meter, but there's a rhythmic structure, and then it could be any melody or even raga kind of melodic structure could be added to it. That's the one I just learned studying Sanskrit. So it's not necessarily the same melody Abhinavagupta sung. Actually, I have a recording of a Kashmiri pundit singing it, and it's different and exquisite. But these were meant to be sung and not meant to just be said or recited. And it's a parallel to the Dzogchen tradition of these songs and also the Siddha tradition of the Buddhist. You see this in Mahamudra as well, these like songs of these Siddhas. And this idea that they would these enlightenment songs, they would sing people into into these states. There's many stories of this as well. And so it's this like this way in which the music and the meaning, you know, kind of blend. And so the stotra tradition is rife with this possibility and power in their community acts as well, right? This was actually chanted regularly in the Swami Lakshman Jews community, the 20th century guru who is from Kashmir. So this was actually a part of their liturgy, you could say, this very text. But
you know, this I want to give you time to, you know, go get something to eat before your next Zoom call, I presume. But this would be an excellent like transition point to talk about the breakthrough, the aha that I had. So I'm gonna ask if I can do that with you, you know, like separately offline. Can
yeah,
I
be happy
you know
to.
Like
yeah.
Send you an email?
Send me an email, yeah. Marco has my email and yeah, absolutely. I would love to hear your experience. And,
yeah, because it has to do with a Gnostic text that I've been.
Oh, wow.
I wish you guys would record this and share it with the group. We have you both have access to, you know, the Zoom call function.
Yeah. Because
then it could be included in this conversation we're having today and we could all watch it. Because Lisa's done a lot with Gnostic texts and I think it would be a fascinating overlap of research going on.
It would, because the text was the one I used in the course, the consciously evolving language course.
Beautiful. I'd be happy. I'm happy.
Please record it. Marco, okay. You could give instruction.
Yeah, definitely.
I can do it. I got the skills.
Yeah. And can you state the name of that text? Because I know you've shared it before. And just for the record, the Gnostic
check.
One. And you're going to.
Oh, the Gnostic one. Okay.
It's called The Thunder Perfect Mind.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The Thunder Perfect Mind. Okay, well, hopefully that will be a follow-up to this conversation. Andre had to duck out early. She let us know in the chat. And Ed was having connection problems. But I think this has been I certainly feel it's been a really rich conversation. So glad you were able to make it, Ben, be with us. And so glad for all your participation and contributions, John, Lisa, Michael. I hope we get to do it again or something like it. Ben, I'll see you soon.
Yeah, definitely. So, thanks for having me and great to be with you all. I really appreciated the conversation. And
thank you, Ben. Many blessings.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
See you blessings. Again. See you around campus.
Hang 10.
Around campus.
Hang 10. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Stay healthy.